Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 20, Carere with Dr. Kevin Smith.
Welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. And strap in is the right term to use at this point. We just said it off air. We have got a recurring, revisiting...
A repeat offender.
Yes. Dr. Kevin Smith. Dr. Kev, as we've now come to call you, because we kind of feel like we're friends now.
Definitely. Absolutely.
Friend of the podcast has rejoined us. And today you're going to be talking to us about a project that you're currently involved with. It's a multi-university, four universities in total. Is it international, Kev?
No, but it's serving as a pilot for an international proposal that we've put out. So fingers crossed, not touch wood, all the other things we do. For luck, hopefully it'll come through. We'll see.
So you better tell us, what is the focus of this project? In a nutshell, what's it about?
Okay. This project was... Well, to start, there's the Welsh government introduced these research networks, collaborative research networks, and I'm a member of the Curriculum and Pedagogy Research Network. And as part of that network, we were talking about different research ideas and new directions that we could go. And given the particular situation that teachers in Wales face with the new curriculum framework, you know, this has been how many years now? What, 8, 9 years now since its announcement. And anecdotally, I think there's many teachers that I talk to who are still not entirely sure if they're doing it right, whatever that means, if they understand what the intentions are. I had a conversation with someone from Welsh government, and they're like, well, you know, the idea is the classrooms will look like Montessori schools. And I thought, where is that written down? Who thought about that? You know, and then has anybody ever heard anybody else say that before? And so I think there's still some ambiguity about it. And so what this project was about was taking a different angle, a different approach to thinking about curriculum. And so we looked towards the United States, to my kind of curricular upbringing, if you will, and the experiences I had, because I was introduced to a method of curriculum theorizing called Carere in my postgraduate studies, in my doctoral studies. And it had such a huge impact on my life because I was a teacher for years in a secondary school in Ohio. And after that experience of teaching, I came to the conclusion that I think teachers are storytellers, just primarily. That's one of our functions. If you think about when you tell a story, it's a very pedagogical kind of activity, isn't it? You know, you've got someone who is kind of leading the storytelling, if you will, but they're not inattentive of their listeners. And in fact, they're trying to ensure their listeners are engaged, that their listeners understand how things progress through the story. The narrative has got to be, interesting, but also tell people something. And hopefully you expect or you hope at the end of that storytelling experience that people walk away feeling edified or that they gained something. And so I've always been persuaded by this idea that teachers are storytellers. And you have people like Ivor Goodson and, of course, once I start naming people, I get a blank sheet of Jill and different people who are saying, you know, maybe we need to think about critical narrative as forms of pedagogy, forms of reflective practice, forms of curriculum theorizing. So that's what this is. And we can kind of get into, I guess, the details of the method here in a minute. But this project was, let's introduce teachers in Wales to Carere, which is an autobiographical form of curriculum theorizing that's informed by existential phenomenological philosophy as well as psychoanalytic techniques, which is a mouthful and sounds like very complicated and has a lot of moving parts, but it's pretty straightforward as far as the premise of the idea goes. The idea is that in this four-stage process of critical self-reflection, you are, as a teacher, you're going to tap into your personal practical knowledge as an educational professional, as someone who is an expert in subject matter, an expert in instruction, an expert in, you know, all these different things that teachers, all these different hats that teachers must wear. And so the first stage is called the regressive phase, where you think back to indelible educational experiences that you've had throughout your life. And it doesn't have to be in school. It can be anywhere, you know, going fishing with your parents and they teach you something. And, you know, like I have a very indelible moment of learning how to tie
a knot?
Flies. Yeah, I was thinking specifically about the knot. I can't remember. But when my dad and I would go fly fishing and we'd tie these knots. So I've been up since 5 o'clock. My wife and I had a gym session this morning.
Strap in.
Yeah. I'm fatigued. Oh, and sorry to interrupt, but I want to tell you about these treats real quick. So we're going to interrupt the regressive phase. This is probably an editing nightmare, isn't it?
It's fine. I'm still applauding the understatement with which you used the words "still some ambiguity." I thought that was really good. That was so well put. Curriculum reform, still some ambiguity. They talk about British understatement.
Well, I recently went back to the States, to Utah, where origins are, and these are some American sweets. These are, in fact, they're from a company called Sweets. These are cinnamon bears, which are lovely, by the way. And then these are saltwater taffies, and they're my favorite. These are funny little, I don't even know what they are. They're called Chico sticks, but they're yummy. And these are some of my kids' favorites, these little strawberry sweets. But the infamous Dad's root beer barrels are in here. Now, the funny thing I've noticed about British folk and root beer is y'all hate it. Because some people tell me it smells like foot medicine.
It's medicinal. Definitely smells medicinal.
Never tried a root beer.
No. There you go. Be careful with the root beer barrels. Because as you as they kind of melt down in your mouth, they can sometimes get a little sharp. I don't know how round objects get sharp, but they do, so be careful. Like everything else in America, just be careful.
The jacket's coming off.
So am I trying a root beer barrel then?
Is you should do whatever you want, but I love the root beer barrels personally.
I don't want to take away your root beer barrels.
This needs to be reserved for the something to try moment, I think. Oh, yeah. I think also, it needs to be Tom has something to try.
Also time for any listener that hasn't found our YouTube versions of our podcasts to log on now. I'm going to try root beer barrel while you tell us about the regressive phase.
Fantastic. Sounds great. So back to the regressive phase. So the regressive phase is critical reflection on indelible educational experiences from the past with the idea that you're going to get inside those moments and really unpack them. So when I'm going through the process, I'd like to organize my reflections around a topic or a theme or something like that. And so when we were working with teachers on this project, we asked them to think about place or think about language or identity or just something that's important to them that they want to have a better understanding of in a kind of curricular sense. And so you reflect on these instances and you write down notes, you create your field notes essentially, you know, and you reflect over an amount of time that you feel is suitable to where you've got that kind of data saturation. And then you go to the next phase, which is called the progressive phase. And the progressive phase is fascinating because you're looking at the future. What are your educational imaginations, your aspirations? What is it that you hope to achieve? And you think about those and you do your field work and stuff like that, your notes, and you jot them down. Then you go into the third phase. And the third phase is called the analytic phase. And that's where you kind of stop for a moment and you say, well, what's happening now? What are the circumstances, the conditions, the features, the characteristics of my current educational practice? And how does the past and the future exist in this moment? And then you write down your notes. Once you've done that, you're going to go into the final phase called the synthetic phase. And what the synthetic phase enables us to do is to take all of our ruminations and reflections and critical considerations, and we distill them down and synthesize them into this cogent statement of curricular understanding. So if the question going in is what it has been and what is now the nature of my educational experience, which is a typical question that kind of launched this approach, at the end, that synthesis statement is the response to that question. And the reason why it's informed by psychoanalytic technique, of course, is this kind of free association self-reflection that you go through. From a social scientist point of view, there's a lot of contention around this idea. Is autoethnographic or autobiographical research social science research? because it's not a social situation, it's an individual situation. But I think it is, in that I don't know where in society the individual ends and society begins. And so I feel like these kinds of autobiographical approaches allow us to kind of get into that space as an individual in society. The other critique we often hear is that, isn't this just critical reflection? And I think, well, why is critical reflection not research? Sometimes people go, well, that's just inquiry. Like, inquiry is not very cool or doesn't mean as much as research, you know. But I like Dewey's approach. Dewey says, well, thinking is research. You know, if you really sit down and are pondering things and trying to understand things and recognize things and systematically organize them so that you can identify new things that have come to life, yeah, that's research. And so this approach to research has these psychoanalytic techniques that help us to recall these experiences and these aspirations through free association. But sometimes that free association can, like I said, be tethered to a topic or a theme. And then the other two components of it are the existential and phenomenological factors. And I love that every time you say the word phenomenological, people's eyes, boop, you know. And I remember when I was first introduced to it, I thought, what in the heck are we talking about, you know? And it is, I think, one of the more kind of sophisticated approaches to philosophy and research. But in phenomenology, there's this concept of the Lebensfeld, the life world. And the life world is the world that we inhabit, but we don't kind of recognize that we're inhabiting it. The life world is this pre-cognitive world of experience. So it's happening to us. And we don't quite catch on until we do catch on. And then that becomes a kind of our consciousness. But there's that pre-moment, that precognitive moment, where you can hopefully strip away your assumptions and your understandings and your orientations and biases and perspectives. You bracket all that apart and you look at just the experience itself to try and get its core or essential meaning. And that's a tricky thing to kind of get our heads around. But that's the phenomenological aspect of it. So as we go into these critical reflections, whether it's the past or the future, the idea is to kind of observe yourself, observing yourself in these moments, to step that one degree of separation away so that you are bracketing your observational stance from your experiential stance so you can strip away those meanings and try to get to what you think is the root of that experience. And the other aspect of it, so there was the psychoanalytic, and then there was the phenomenological. And then the last part is the, I don't know why I'm pointing around like that, but it helps. The other thing is this existential philosophy. And people often ask, well, like, how does existential philosophy fit into this? And I think for me, the best way to answer that question is to say that in existentialism, there's a famous quote, I think it's from Sartre, that says existence precedes essence, right? The idea that you aren't born with an essential identity. It's not given to you by God. It's not made for you by society. You are just what you are, and eventually you will become what you will become. And so this idea that this simply because I exist and there's no future set for me, you know, I get to make my own path, then I must study myself so that I can make the decisions to become who I want to become. If I don't live my life in a critical, self-reflective fashion, am I living my life in good faith, for instance, which is another concept from existentialism, is, you know, if we recognize our radical freedom in the universe and our existence is kind of a manifestation of our radical freedom, you know, we were brought into the universe. I didn't get to choose to be born. And that's kind of like why we suffer, isn't it? Because we're living life and we didn't get to choose it. So we have to just suffer it. But this idea that if we embrace this suffering and that we think about our choices and the consequences of our choices and we live our life determinedly, then that is living in good faith. And I feel like the only way we can really do that is through conscious, critical self-reflection. And that's how that kind of slots into this method. What that means for teachers, I think, if we go back to this beautiful little book by John Dewey called The Sources of a Science of Education, written in 1929. It's about 93, 91 pages. It's a little pamphlet, really. And in that, he has this quote where he says that he feels like the lives of teachers and their experiences in the classroom are essentially like an unworked mine, and that the sources of a science of education could be found in teachers' experiences of the classroom and their kind of scientific, the Deweyan kind of idea science, their scientific understanding of themselves, their classroom, the children they find themselves in association with, those kinds of things. So the idea here is if we look at what happens in classrooms as not just instruction to children or the delivery of a curriculum, that always drives me crazy. Oh, we're going to deliver the curriculum. You know, rock up in your white van and leave it on the doorstep. You know, that's what it feels like, you know. And so if we actually look at how people experience curriculum, not only in how they experience it as a teacher, but how they have experienced it in their lives, you can bring all this knowledge and all this wisdom to bear on what you're doing now so you can make a better sense of where you're going in the future. So I think in a nutshell, that's the method.
You're going to, because I'm trying to maneuver my way around a dad's root beer barrel. So you have a question.
Yeah, I just,
I'm going to deliver some sweets in your direction.
Well, yeah, I'll grab one in a minute. I think I'm clear on the method and also the purpose. I think for anyone out there that's still unclear on that term, curere, and how it contrasts to curriculum, can you give us a bit of explanation about that and why? Because I'm looking at your notes now, and this movement emerged in the early 1970s that shifted the focus from curriculum to curere. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about those terms?
Sure. Yep. It's one of my favorite stories to tell about how curriculum kind of came to be. I wrote about it briefly in an article I published a couple of years ago called Ambulare, which is my take on the curere method. And so ambulare is the Latin word for to walk. And curere is the Latin word to run, basically. So if we look at curriculum, the term curriculum is a Latin word that means course to be run. And it focuses, you know, if you watch an old Ben-Hur, you know, if you'll watch Ben-Hur and you see the chariots going around the Colosseum there, that's the curriculum. And it's a course to be run. And that suggests an emphasis on syllabi and materials and objectives and those kinds of things, which is fine. But in 1969, a curriculum theorist named Joseph Schwab got up at the American Educational Research Association conference and made this announcement that kind of shocked people at the time. And at the time, we were talking 1969, 1970, the field of curriculum had only really been around for about 40 or 50 years in the United States. It formed in the United States in the early 1920s when they were trying to do some national research on what are the best ways to organize learning in schools. You had committees of 10 and 15, and they were all debating over whether we should have more progressive approaches or more traditional approaches and what models of curricula we should use and those kinds of things. And up in the 1969, 1970, Joseph Schwab gets up and he says, the field of curriculum is dead. It's moribund. It can no longer achieve its aims of improving school outcomes and educational experiences. And he said the reason why is because there's basically these flights to, from, and of the field. He said there were too many influences from the physical sciences, the natural sciences, even the social sciences that might not be appropriate to educational concerns or circumstances. There were ideas from other industries, like from business, for instance, that were introducing ideas of efficient curriculum making. And he said those might not be appropriate. And at the time, there was a lot of contention between theorists. And so there's a lot of ad hominem debate, and it just was to the point where he felt like, you know, we've got to do something. And he called for a renaissance of the field. And for him, what he felt like was important is we focus on the practical, which is just obviously it's not the banal, mundane kind of bitty pieces, but it's how do you as an educator really go about doing the work of an educator? And then there's the quasi-practical and the eclectic. So people were sitting around listening to this, and it made a lot of sense to them. They were recognizing truth in what he was saying. But at the time, no one really figured out how do we respond to this. So the idea, kind of the suggestion was, we focus on the practical, we focus on what happens in classrooms, we're going to see, you know, that kind of research start taking off. And then this fella, this guy named William Pienaar, says, well, I have a response to this. I want to reconceptualize curriculum. I don't even want to deal with curriculum as we currently understand it. Let's bring it, reconstruct it in a new way. So that's when he came up with the term curare. And for him, the reconceptualization of curriculum is a focus on analyzing experience, analyzing educational experience specifically. So that's why it's important to bring in these existential and phenomenological components to help us do that. And so the reconception of curriculum from curriculum, a course to be run, to curare, how am I running the race, became the focus of this reconceptualist movement because of the skepticism of scientism that was being brought in from the social sciences and other sciences, because of the political and social and cultural disruptions that were going on at the time in the early 1970s, particularly in the United States. You know, he felt like there was an opportunity there for teachers to engage in public conversations about what's happening in schools as a way to improve public education and to maintain public education and to ensure that we're educating people for democratic purposes, those kinds of things. So there's lots of different factors that came into to the shaping of the movement. But there's also this critical component that we're looking at the system as it exists now with the idea of improving it for future. And the reconceptualization of curriculum from focusing on those things that we do or have for curriculum into the individual's experience of curriculum was just something that no one ever considered before. But I think it's funny, you know, if you think about, if you go to a, you can imagine a couple going to a travel agency and they want to go on a holiday. So they shop around and someone says, well, here's a holiday and you can go look at these things at this particular time. And then at the end of your trip, you're going to take a survey and you're going to talk about everything you've already done. That feels a lot like curriculum to me. You know, you're going to go learn these things at this time of the year. I've specially prepared this curriculum for you. There's not a lot of choice and for you as an individual because I've already made these choices for you. And at the end of the curriculum, you're going to have an exam, that kind of a thing. Can you imagine though, if you went on a if you went to a travel agency and they planned this holiday for you and they never conceived or even thought to comprehend what your experience of that holiday would be? And that really came home to me when I was reading about about curare and the reconceptualization of curriculum, because if we find ourselves as curriculum workers, as teachers, as educators, planning educational experiences, but not considering the experience of the people we're working with, then what are we doing it for? You know, and particularly here in Wales, where the Curriculum for Wales framework really privileges this concept of experience, doesn't it? Poorly defines it, in my opinion. I think it's like what all experiences children have at school. That's a cop-out, in my opinion. And that's not the first time that definition's been raised. But there's 101 different definitions of curriculum, so I guess, you know, they chose one. And maybe they chose the one that was the least controversial. I don't know. I've become a little more critical, hope you guys don't mind, of the of the Curriculum for Wales. I don't not believe in it. I just wish we had done some things differently over the course of time. But anyway, so if we're looking at the reconceptualization of curriculum as an understanding of experience, then I think what that does for teachers specifically is it provides them the space to get inside what they're doing as an individual who's concerned about helping the lives of others, really is what education is all about. And they get to examine their own experience and then they write this up. And that's maybe the most important part of this whole process is the teacher, the researcher, whatever we want to frame them as, is writing this all up and sharing it with people, publishing it, put it on Hub, you know, send it to a journal, give it to your friends at school, whatever. But the idea is that you are preparing yourself to engage in public conversations about education and about how you go about doing it.
And the thing I'm curious about is how you encourage and support these teachers to examine it as a thing when it's something that seems to be so somatic. So you live it, you feel it. And it must be quite confronting if you're asking them to reflect on the way they're experiencing curriculum, but then to step back from that and go, so what does that mean about me as a practitioner? How do you support them in that process?
That is, I think, that is where the real work comes. Because, you know, you can always reflect on stuff and you bring these memories in. But reflection is not just bringing those memories and reconstructing that experience. It's about also analyzing and interpreting those things. Some people in a piece of creativity will just write what they think is their understanding. And they might not even refer to other pieces of literature, other pieces of research. They might, and they can be as creative as they want. There's no formula or template. You can write a poem. Part of the project that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, some of the folks, we have graphic artists who are involved in it, so they're going to be doing illustrative pieces for us. But I find it helps quite a bit when you are analyzing your different data and you bring together your understanding organized around that principle or theme that I was talking about. So like one of my research students, Andy Williams, is doing a great project using Curare as a means to help teachers think about what agency means to them. When did they have agentic moments in the classroom? When did they not? How do they overcome it? What are the factors that lead to it, kind of thing? And what is useful about that is once you go through the process and you start putting these things together, then you read the other literature and you think, okay, well, what does, Priestley and Biesta say about teacher agency, for instance, or what does Biesta and Tedder say about models of agency, or Amber Byron Meach say about it? And how do these theories, what I think we often miss about research, and we asked me a great question last time I was on the podcast about how should teachers engage with educational research. And I was like, well, it's never an answer. And I still believe that. And I also believe that you can get these data from the research, just like you can get data from this Curare process. But you have to take that in consideration of what is going on in your classroom and outside your classroom, what's going on with your practice, and then also what's going on out in the field. And you're going to have these different points of data that you've generated. You're going to have these different kind of touchstones from all the things that you've read, but it's theory that's going to stitch all that together for you. Theory fills in the gaps. Theory adjoins things together for us. It's what kind of situates meaning and understanding and gives it concreteness for us. And so I feel like when teachers go through and they get this kind of like individual personalized understanding of their experience through the Curare method, once they then engage their voice in a conversation with other literature, that it really comes to life. That's when those connections come together and you can have really powerful pieces of Curare where you would have thought, I would have never read this in any other kind of research.
It's making me think about ethics.
Yeah.
It strikes me that this might not be an easy process for some teachers to go through. So how do you sort of mitigate the risk of someone having a breakdown about this when they come? Because it can be quite confronting, can't
yes,
it?
You yes. know? Well, and anytime, like this is a big consideration. We were talking about ethics and talking to my PhD students about it. And I said, you know, autobiographical approaches, autoethnographic approaches have different ethical considerations, because even though you're both the research instrument and the subject of research, you can still you're still a vulnerable person in that you might divulge something. You know, I wrote in the piece that I wrote about kind of like the areas where I go walking. Well, now people know where I go walking, right? So should I be concerned? You know, no, because no one reads the paper. So, but, you know, those kinds of things. And if I write about, like in that paper, I wrote about my mother. So what I did is, as I was walking and reflecting on those pieces, and I realized that I was telling a story that involved someone else in a meaningful way, I called my mom right away. I said, look, here's a project I'm working on, and these are the ideas, and would you be interested in being a part of that? And here's how I envision that happening. And so we got retroactive kind of – first of all, I got a general kind of ethical approval from my mother. And then after I wrote up my notes and I kind of send it back to her and I said, member check, what do you think about this? You know, she said, oh yeah, this is fine. You know, and we kind of worked together until it was a published piece to make sure that I wasn't telling a story that she didn't want told, or that I wasn't divulging anything that made her feel vulnerable. And this is one of the tricks about autoethnographic and autobiographical approaches. Because I have colleagues who have done credere pieces and maybe weren't as diligent or careful, or maybe they just didn't, they just didn't think about it at the time, but it hurt their family members. It's hurt their friends. So you do have to be very careful. And sometimes when we are reflecting on these indelible moments, feelings happen, don't they?
Yeah.
You know? And I always tell people when we sit down and do workshops, like as part of this, you know, that sometimes you might have, I hate using the word trigger, but you might have a memory that triggers some kind of a response. And so, you know, we have hotline, we have these resources and stuff. But I personally don't think that anything that's autobiographical or that is autoethnographic should be therapized, basically. We're not therapizing ourselves. I want it to stay focused on professional, pedagogical, curricular kinds of things and not like this really introspective harrowing of my soul kind of a thing, you know. So I think you have to set boundaries.
And if we were to replace your maternal ethics committee with perhaps one's bosses or one's colleagues, I suppose when we look in education, we've got kind of two problems at opposite extremes, really. You've got the problem that everybody talks about messy conversations and difficult inquiries, and let's put it all on the table. And my response is always, are you really sure you want that? Because, you know, I'm not sure you do. On the other hand, you might have somebody listening to this going, yes, this is my opportunity to, you know, break the shackles and rebel. Is there a middle way there, if you are going to use this in a practical sense, where they perhaps don't follow your career path of getting sacked early on in their career, but on the other hand, they can still be critical and they can still avoid this slight, everything's great, let's brush it under the carpet reaction to the messy conversation that apparently people were craving at the start?
I think there are processes, procedures you can follow that will help mitigate ethical conundrums or challenges. And so open communication is hugely important. And also, if you're just going to do a bit of credere as part of a personal project that will never see the light of day kind of thing, you know, well, do you need ethical approval? You know, but if you're going to be sharing it, publishing it, then absolutely. And there are guides for autobiographical and autoethnographic approaches to this kind of research, or ethic considerations in this kind of research. But I always say, you know, if you are reflecting and it involves the classroom, the teacher in the classroom across the corridor from you and somebody down, you better bring them in and say, well, actually, you know, I'm thinking about doing this, and just clear the air. And if they say no, then you don't write about them, you know. But there's also, you can also play with things a little bit in credere. You can fictionalize accounts. So you can use pseudonyms, you can relocate things in places. The main key here is to preserve fidelity and the fidelity of what it is you're trying to know. Individuals' identities aren't necessarily important when it comes to these kinds of things. What you're trying to figure out is like relational conditions or you know, those kinds of interactive components. So you can restory. So essentially what this is I think part of the reason why people say, well, it's not research, is because this, according to William Pienaar, who developed the method, this method is best situated in the humanities, not in the social sciences. But it's kind of crossed over. And, you know, of course, the humanities have their own approaches to research. Of course, they do. But it is different to the social sciences. And it's funny because, like, I'm in the School of Social Sciences, Cardiff University, but I'm probably half and half split of humanities and social science, which is kind of why I have one foot in credere and one foot in, you know, regular quote-unquote research. But I think it's open conversations. It's operating in good faith. It's really, you know, points to a larger problem I think we have in general in schools, but particularly here in Wales, as evidenced by all the professional learning that we've been going on, these reforms that we've had to try and improve school conditions for teachers, is that there's just no time for people to talk to each other in meaningful ways about what they want to do in the classroom. Because I bet you 99% of the time, if there's something that you want to do in the classroom, if you were able to sit down with your colleagues in an environment that actually nurtured these kinds of conversations, you would be able to do it. And then think how innovative, how engaging, how, you know, future-facing our educational system would be if we actually had these opportunities for teachers.
And I suppose if I was to put on a real cynic's hat now, I might come to you and say, okay, so what, how is it going to benefit me and how is it going to benefit my learners? Mm. If I dedicate the time to this, I go through the process, what's the impact?
Mm. It's amazing that you just said that, because I had I'd posted on Twitter or something, a blog I had written about the project, and someone messaged me on there and said, oh, thanks for sharing that. We get this aspect of it, but like, what does it really mean for teachers in terms of their curriculum design? I thought, okay. Well, you know, if you are engaged in some kind of an activity and you're not thinking about how you're engaging in the activity, well, there's an opportunity to learn right there. And once you actually start doing that in a systematic way, in good faith, if you embody the reflective practices that Dewey talks about, open-mindedness, wholeheartedness, and responsibility to what it is you're doing, I think you're going to benefit from it. I think you're going to learn something new about who you think you are, who you think the people are that you're working with in the classroom, what it is you think you're going to accomplish, because you're actually sitting down and giving it like proper weighty consideration. It's not, you know, airy-fairy, let me just sit around and think for a while. I mean, these are purposeful, meaningful, let's get to the bottom of what I think these educational experiences, how has my life as a learner and now an educator, but also, you know, for me, a husband, a father, friend, a neighbor, whatever, all of these opportunities, all these relationships I have are opportunities to create educational experiences. We have more educational experiences outside of school than we do in school. They're just not organized for us and they're not readily identified by us because they're just our life, right? But if we can stop and freeze these moments, the past ones, and just really get into them, we're going to learn something from them. And that's what I think is the potential here. So, you know, it might not give people a model for how to develop curriculum. And thank God. You know, do we need any more tour brochures? Here's where you're going to go. Here's what you're going to do. Fill out the survey at the end. Well, we've done that. You know, so what are we doing now? What are we doing now as educators here in Wales that is really going to make an impact? And I don't know if it's answered with pedagogy. I don't know if it's answered with curriculum. I do think, though, that if teachers were given the time, the space, the resources, the money needed to actively reflect in these kinds of ways, we would see new innovations. We would see new ideas. We would see a burgeoning of pedagogical professional practice, curriculum practice happening here in Wales.
And we do live in a time where I think many schools are on board with the idea of getting their teachers to involve themselves in some form of professional learning, reflection, inquiry, that kind of thing. You know, you're a man with philosopher tattoos on yourself, and even you have given us the odd health warning about some of them that their writing is not the most accessible. So no tour guides, but if somebody's sold, what's the accessible way into Karere as an approach? I'm not saying kind of boil it down to sort of real basic tour guide stuff, but if they'd like to have a go, where do they go to find something that's not going to frighten them off?
Good question. Let me think. So read Leaving Safe Harbors by Dennis Carlson. It's not specifically about Karere, but it's about myth. And he's using Greek myths as well as contemporary culture at the time, songs by The Clash and films like Dead Poets Society and stuff like that, to kind of tease out these ideas and to help us think about what might a future of education look like where we're concerned about not only whether or not children learn well and get the quote-unquote knowledge they need, but that they can do so in a way that helps them live lives that flourish and that they can form identities and interactions and relationships and stuff. So Leaving Safe Harbors is a great book. And I think Tom Tom Petter and Denise Talfour-Bazile are editors of a journal called the Carrere Exchange Journal, which is an open access journal, and they publish all sorts of examples of Carrere. Carrere pieces are typically pretty short, about 5,000 words, and they go to peer review, so they're double-blinded reviewed. They go through the editorial process. So these are real scholarly pieces of work, but really accessible. They're written by everyday people like us, you know? So you don't have to go into these really weighty, heavy, let me go read Merleau-Ponty and Phenomenology or Heidegger or Husserl or anything like that, because that is the hard stuff, right? But start by reading examples of Carrere. And then there are great books that William Parnar's written. One is called What is Curriculum Theory? And he talks a little bit about Carrere and reconceptualism in that book. But there's another book that I like, which is he's written some chapters of it and then collected it's a volume of other essays. And it's called, The Reconceptualists, I think. Curriculum Theory, The Reconceptualists. And that's another excellent book. If you want to try and get your hands around it, there's another journal called the Journal of Curriculum Theorizing. Tom Petter's been the editor for that for about 6 years now. And they have just released their back catalog of issues. And so these are the very first publications of the journal. This is in the early 70s when Parnar was developing the method, when he was talking about how do we reconceptualize curriculum. And it's got important essays by Peter McLaren, Henry Giroux, Michael Apple, Bill Pinar, Cameron McCarthy, Bill Reynolds, all these people, Gene Anion, like lots of important folks. And so I think the journal Curriculum Theorizing is another one to get into. Sometimes there's heavy stuff in there because there's a strong philosophical contingent in the reconceptualist movement. And they want to talk about posthumanism and all stuff like that. And it can be a little... It's fun, but sometimes I read them, I go, huh, you know, it's going to take a couple more times to go through that. You know?
Yeah.
And as my dad's root beer barrel comes to an end, that tells me it's time for us to move on to the short slots. And very nice that root beer barrel was too. Something interesting or something to try? We'll give you the choice of which one to do first.
Let's try the something interesting first, if you want. And it's related to embodied cognition. So... a friend of mine named Sheila McCrean and two friends of mine, Jennifer Fugate, wrote a book called Embodied Cognition, and it kind of changed it really helped me get over kind of Cartesian dualism. Dewey had already kind of brought me to the precipice, and then they pushed me over the edge, right? Because they're cognitive scientists, and you know how, like, cognitive science is often used, I think, as a kind of truncheon to hit teachers over the head with, you know? How's that cognitive load going for you kind of stuff, you know? And maybe we could just chill out about that kind of stuff a little bit, because the way that cognitive load, for instance, gets used, I don't think is really doesn't have a lot of verisimilitude to what the evidence is saying it does. But anyway, the thing Sheila sent me this, or she tweeted this little video, and I thought, oh, 48 minutes. Am I going to want to sink 48 minutes into an online video? I don't know. It was like, what can we learn from worms and frogs is what it said. And I thought, why not? Click. You know, I'm on the train. Here we go. I was engrossed because it's a biologist who they made an eye grow on a tadpole on its bum. So when the frog grew up, there was an eye on the back of its bum. And I thought, you know, that's strange. But what it goes to prove is that they were able to reprogram the cells of the frog to think that the cells that they were operating with were eye cells and not other kinds of cells. And then the body grew it. The spinal cord sent a nerve down to the eye. It's a functioning eye on the back of a frog. It's wild, right? So then he segues and he says, let me tell you about these planetarium worms. And he says, you can take one of these worms. And I think the world record for slicing these little guys up is like 274 pieces. And every time he slices these little worms, a new worm grows from the old worm. So you'd have 276 worms or whatever it was, right? You can take these worms and put them in a petri dish with different textures and textures they don't like and food that they want, and they will move around the petri dish, and you can train them. You can train worms, which is, I thought, wild, right? Then you cut that worm up, and all those little individual pieces grow into worms, and they remember the training. And I thought, now, wait a minute. You know, how does that happen? And of course, there's these ideas that in evolution, that knowledge is passed down in our DNA, you know, and there's different ideas about how we acquire language, about how children know how to latch onto mom's breast, those kinds of things. You know, and we always kind of dismiss it as, well, it's instinct. Well, it's not. It's an operating system. It's bios. It's built into our DNA. This guy goes so far as to contend that the cells that comprise our body are comprised of agentic material, and that we are actually a collective intelligence. If you think about, like, the example I always use is in when I went and saw The Phantom Menace, the Star Wars prequel, and I was really mad at George Lucas because he took the mysticism out of the Force by saying that it was midichlorians that communicate the Force to individuals. And midichlorians, you could have certain numbers of midichlorians in your body. And I was mad because I thought that essentializes the Force. It means that people with more midichlorians can be Force sensitive, and somebody might not have midichlorians and they can't be Force sensitive. And I wanted everybody to have the Force. I was literally upset by that. That's how big of a fan nerd I was. But the reason why he did that is because of collective intelligence. Our biome, our gut biome influences our mood, influences our perception. The single-celled organisms in our bodies that live in communities, in our muscles, in our blood, et cetera, they're working to communicate with each other. And because of them being agentic material, these worms can maintain those memories. And I think just what it does is it demonstrates the complexity and the sophistication of what it means to be a human being and what it means to be a cognizant, conscientious, sentient being. And if we think about the fact that we don't just know with our brains and that we don't just exist in our heads, but that we know with our bodies and that the communities of intelligences that comprise our collective intelligence also know and can do things and make decisions. We're going to grow an eye here. That means there are profound implications for how we go about organizing curriculum, how we go about teaching people, how we assess and evaluate knowledge and their performance of knowledge, et cetera. It just, that I thought just really blew my mind.
It's blown mine. Okay. What do you want people to try?
You should definitely try Dad's root beer, but...
oh, hang on. Tom, what's the verdict?
All right, yeah. Good. Difficult to podcast with one in your mouth, so I probably might...
You're quite chewy?
No, very hard.
Very hard, okay.
Yeah, if you're into chewy, the saltwater taffy is the way to go.
I think I just had one. Was it? There was licorice in the one I had.
Oh, was it white with black stripe?
That was a surprise.
Oh, yeah. Are you okay with licorice?
Yeah, I'm all right with it.
The ones that there's one there that's yellow and green. And if I remember correctly, it's banana and lime. And, oh, yeah, just to save that one.
So that's something not to try.
No, it's definitely. That's my favorite one. But so recently, I told you before we started the podcast, I went back to see my family in Utah. And I hadn't seen my sister in years. And my sister and I were really close growing up. And then just over the course of time, just didn't. And now we're getting back together again and kind of rediscovering our relationship, which is fab. And my sister is super creative. She's one of those people that just can do anything. So she's a singer. My whole family's like this. She can sing. She can perform. She's lately she's been doing pottery. And she just felt like there was something missing out of her life. And it was about 15 years ago. So she just went to YouTube, started watching people doing pottery, thought, that's what I want to do, bought a little $150 wheel at home and started, whatever. And now she makes these beautiful pieces of art. And so when we went there, she's like, I want to show you how to do pottery. And I thought, oh, I can't. I'm not creative. I'm not that. I can't do it. And so we sat down at the wheel and I loved it. And we made little, tumblers and stuff like that. But I think just one is it was a special experience for me to sit down with my sister and have a pedagogical moment with her. Like, I can't think of a moment where she and I sat down and taught and learned and like really tried to help each other in that kind of pedagogical way. And I think that's a aspect of the human relationship and the human experience that is so special. And so like her guiding me, supporting me, teaching me how to do it and me having that really tactile experience. Like she was telling me, anytime you touch it, the wheel's got to be moving. And if you have your hands together, so if I've got my hands inside the tumbler and other hands on the outside and I'm trying to raise the wall of it, I need to have my two hands touching each other. Well, I never thought about these kind of little details. And to learn those kinds of things, it was just a special experience. So I think you should try throwing pottery. I mean, I don't know where people can do it. I wish there was a place you could just kind of rock up. Like there used to be a place in Cardiff where you could go, like a kitchen. You could go with your friends and cook a meal or have a cooking class. There should be a pottery class. That was such a remarkable, enjoyable, but also just a special kind of educational moment for me.
It's making me think about, we have the privilege of interviewing, you can imagine, lots at the moment, not so many, student teachers for our PGCE programmes. And one of the things that we ask them to do is to do a micro teach for us. And we interview them together. And often I am out of my comfort zone.
Well, not that often, because you don't have that many music candidates. I'm more often out of mine.
But there have been some absolutely beautiful moments, yes. Tom, haven't there?
Yes, where you learning the French horn on a piece of hose pipe with a funnel sticking out of it was definitely a highlight for me.
Yeah. So although it's not, you know, sitting at a potter's wheel, which just sounds sublime, and I might have a little think about it myself, just learning something new and being outside of your comfort zone, but, you know, sort of opening yourself up to be a bit vulnerable with someone that, you know, you maybe already had an established sort of hierarchy or relationship with. It's quite nice having those moments, isn't it?
I think there was a sense of vulnerability that she had as well.
Yeah.
Because we were, in a way, reintroducing ourselves to each other. But she was sharing something that she loved with me. And I think there is a sense of vulnerability when you say, I've got something special and I want to show you that. We're vulnerable that way. And that was, if I can go a little bit further, I'm sorry, but there's a wonderful academic in the States by the name of Dr. Theodora Regina Barry. And she and I were recording a podcast for my radical education module, and we were talking about bell hooks's engaged pedagogy. And Dr. Barry said that what makes it magical, or what makes it happen, right, this engaged pedagogy, is vulnerability. That the teacher recognizes the vulnerability of the situation, but also shares a degree of vulnerability in establishing this kind of common ground from which we can learn, because often that vulnerability gets in the way, but when we share it, it opens up channels of communication. And I felt like that definitely happened at the potter's wheel, but it also happens in the classroom.
Dr. Kev, you have excelled yourself again.
You have, and it's been a privilege. As ever, it's given us lots to think about, and we wish you the best of luck for however long left. How long do you have left of this research project?
We are wrapping up our drafts in June. We should have them submitted to a journal in the autumn, so they should be published hopefully before Christmas.
Oh, your journals are faster than the ones I submit to then.
It'll probably be spring, but I'm optimistic.
Thank you, Dr. Kev. Don't get me started on journals. We will be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Our special guest this episode was Dr. Kevin Smith from Cardiff University. Thanks to Kev for taking part and for the sweets. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support by Ethan Walsh, and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.